We're chatting this morning with Dr. Joe St. Pierre of Hartford Healthcare. He's a medical weight loss specialist in the Fairfield region and joins us now this morning. Good morning, Dr. St. Pierre. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me today. I'm doing well.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here this morning. I don't think it's any secret, Dr. St. Pierre. Usually every time the new year rolls around, people are interested in losing weight, getting healthy, getting into shape. So tell us a little bit about how we should be making weight loss resolutions. We want to do it in a healthy way and something that is sustainable.
Absolutely, 100% correct. Always examine specifically why you want to lose weight and make sure you're doing it for the best reasons. And when I say that specifically, I'm talking about making sure we're doing it to help reduce blood pressure, help reduction of chronic disease items, help to avoid diabetes, these types of things. We all get excited about trying to lose weight to enhance our physical attributes, but that really should be secondary compared to all the other underlying chronic health diseases that obesity can lead to.
So it's funny you say that, Dr. St. Pierre. Years ago, a while ago, I had gone through a medically run weight loss program for my job, and it was called Medi Weight Loss. People are probably very familiar with it. There are several locations across Connecticut, and I was very stunned when I first went in, because after they do your initial consultation, they're like, we can't get started until we do a series of health tests. We have to do an EKG. We've got to do blood tests. We've got to do breathing tests. And I thought to myself, why so extensive? Why are we doing all of these things? And the reason being, because of what you just said, we have to make sure that we even prep our bodies to be ready to go through whatever weight loss program we want to go through, and making sure that we are keeping with the nutrients or that we're working with what our bodies are currently going through. And that's something I think a lot of people miss if they decide to do certain diets or they try to follow societal norms. And so it sounds like you're saying this is really something, if you're serious about losing weight in a healthy way, to consult a doctor or a dietitian or to speak to somebody about it. Or is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, both are excellent choices. Honestly, we've come a long way in the last 10 years in the medical community with obesity being accepted as a chronic disease. And when we try and run these tests specifically, oftentimes we're looking for underlying health issues, like you said. But on top of it, we want to make sure we try and tailor what we do that would be as specific to you as possible. Because there's a lot of hot button topics within the medical community right now when they talk about things like precision medicine and, like, what exactly does that mean? Because you're right, absolutely. When you go out into, you know, see various doctors or for various other things out there, generally you try and get funneled through a one-size-fits-all type situation. And so when we try and do these things now, we're trying to tailor these specifically more to your needs.
So we're talking this morning to Hartford Healthcare medical weight loss specialist, Dr. Joe St. Pierre, and a lot of people focused on weight loss. And you know, I have to be honest with you, Dr. St. Pierre, we've talked a lot about weight loss and just trying to get healthy in the new year during January. And it's not to be redundant. I just really do feel like we are very drawn to what society will tell us to do. We are very focused on what is the quickest way to lose weight and the fastest way. We don't really care about the long term. We don't look at down the road. And I think it's become a bigger and bigger problem, and people have been seeing more health issues and wondering, why isn't this working? And one of the things you had said was determining why you even want to lose weight. What do you mean by that? Like, when you say figure out why this is your goal, what are you looking for people to do?
Yeah, I think one of the big things to recognize with the way we're approaching excess weight and obesity now is to understand obesity typically is 50-80% genetic, but genes are not destiny. So ultimately, there has to be something in your environment that's causing the expression of these genes. So there's going to be some type of chronic stressor, whether, you know, various things in your life, whether you just gave birth, your child rearing. We all just live or currently living through the COVID-19 pandemic, maybe marriages, divorces, deaths in family. All these chronic stressors in our lives will ultimately lead to some type of dysregulated eating at some point in our lives. And same thing with chronic injury, or we injure our back or things like that, and then suddenly we became less active over time. Typically, when we're less active, that doesn't necessarily mean we ultimately regulate how much we actually end up eating. Typically, we usually end up eating the same amount, even though we're being less physically active. And over time, that stuff takes a toll, and it just continues to kind of slowly come on over time. So when you're talking about wanting to do this healthy, it doesn't come on fast. Typically, it doesn't come off fast, and that's okay. That's normal, all right? You're thinking about a half a pound to 2 pounds per week. That's what's considered healthy and sustainable, not anything that's like a crash diet or apple cider vinegar or things that you're going to drop 25 pounds in, 3 weeks.
So we're talking this morning to Dr. Joe St. Pierre. I'm just curious, Dr. St. Pierre, we are going to take a quick break, but is there a difference between weight loss and medical weight loss programs?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a board-certified internal medicine doctor, and I'm boarded by the American Board of Obesity Medicine. And the differences between what I do and what my colleagues at HHC do is, obviously, we recommend different lifestyle changes, physical activity, dietary changes that you could get out of, things like Weight Watchers. But additionally, we're medical doctors. So we do use medical weight loss medications as tools to help kind of assist to make that process easier.
So there are non-surgical and surgical options, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, so we typically utilize FDA-approved weight loss medications. The biggest barrier with those items right now, currently insurance barriers, trying to get more broader acceptance within the insurance community of covering these types of things as a need for avoiding, terrible things down the road. And then the surgical options are the typical surgical options that have been there that a lot of people have heard about, things like gastric sleeve, gastric bypass, which currently right now within the medical community is considered the gold standard for weight loss. You lose a lot of weight using a gastric sleeve and gastric bypass.
We're chatting this morning with Dr. Joe St. Pierre, who is a Hartford Healthcare Medical Weight Loss Specialist for the Fairfield region. And really quickly, before we move on to children, Dr. St. Pierre, you had said you have FDA-approved weight loss medications that you'll sometimes prescribe for people. And immediately I thought of like Ozempic, the fact that people are starting to use Ozempic as a weight loss drug and not what it was actually meant
That's
to
right.
do. I was just
That's
curious,
right.
what qualifies you to get on some of these medications? Because I'd imagine a lot of people are going to want to use them.
Yeah, so the general typical guideline is if you have a BMI over 30, that classifies you as class 1 obesity. You qualify for the most part for any type of medical weight loss drug at that point. If your BMI is between 27 and 30, then you need to have a weight-related comorbid condition, such as blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, that type of thing.
Okay. So you obviously you have to be, have something either underlying or something you're currently going through to qualify for it. But like, again, going back to Ozempic, I'm finding that people don't actually need Ozempic. They're just using it for weight loss. So how do they skip those boundaries, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so I'm not sure on that 100%. I know this is all over the media right now. It's on TikTok. It's everywhere. I could tell you this is the most sought after medication right now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Those are the specific guidelines I know. And, with regards to Ozempic being semaglutide, the differences here is that, Ozempic and Wegovy are the actual same medication. And I think there's like very nuanced difference here because it's actually different at the higher doses, but all the entry-level doses for Ozempic and Wegovy are the actual same until you get above 1.0. And I think that is, I'm not sure why the manufacturer did it this way, if this is a way to kind of get it through the FDA approval process, but that's what has generated some of the confusion. And I think there's been a lot more acceptance within the insurance community with regards to wanting to cover Ozempic because it is labeled as a type 2 diabetes medication, even though it's the same medication as the Wegovy. So there's a lot of confusion there, and I think a lot of that stuff's going to have to be rectified over time.
Okay. We're talking to Dr. Joe St. Pierre, Hartford Healthcare Medical Weight Loss Specialist. Let's talk about kids, if you don't mind, Dr. St. Pierre. I saw before the pandemic, so pre-pandemic numbers show here on Connecticut Records that a little more than a quarter, more than 25% of children are either considered overweight or obese. Again, that's pre-pandemic. I would imagine, I'm just going to make an educated guess. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I'd imagine that number has gone up. just because of stress, anxiety, depression, everything else. So with that being said, what do you think is happening? Why are we seeing that kids are struggling with weight at such a young age? Is this something we've always seen? And what can we do to combat it?
Yeah, no, these are very, very excellent questions that have to go forth to policymakers, the finances and solutions for, because the reality is this is not something that has been happened before in recent history. And I'm trying to remember the statistics back to the 70s. I want to say it was like less than 12% of childhood or children in elementary school were obese. And now that number's increased almost exponentially over that period of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's probably a multitude of reasons. When we're talking about weight and obesity, it's usually always end up being more than, one specific item. And when you look back at schools too, I mean, I don't know, I can't say for certain from when I went through school, but it seems like there's less focus on, you know, phys ed, which is one thing. So we're becoming less physically active at that time. And additionally, too, we're talking about the types of foods that are marketed to children. I mean, when I go back and I think about the things that I had when I was a kid, I mean, I ate like fruit roll-ups and gummy bears and things like that, right? And these are not exactly the healthiest things that you can get. And I think that stuff becomes more readily available. And to exacerbate that further point, we also have, you know, in a household where if it's either a single parent or we have parents that have to work multiple jobs, it's very hard to sit down and have a good, nutritious meal because you're always running on the run, trying to grab what's fast to get everybody, you know, at least something to eat.
The other thing, though, I was going to ask, Doctor, and maybe I'm being too, you know, chill about it, but do you also think that the way that we calculate obesity, is that archaic? Because, you know, sometimes you'll hear people like your BMI or something. So when I look in a mirror, like I'm a size six. I feel like for a 5'5" woman, I'm like a size six. I think I look fine. I mean, I fit in medium sized clothing pretty much across the board. But I am considered overweight. That would be considered overweight for my stature. I think I should be down to like, I should be, I think, on a healthy level, I should be like 135 pounds. I'm not. So I'm just curious, like, have we also sort of changed the way that we look at what is considered obesity or overweight? It, like, is, does that also factor into these numbers?
Yeah, you know, this is such a fantastic question because at its most fundamental level, what we're asking is what exactly is BMI?
Right.
We all know it. Body mass index, we know it's a calculation, but how was it actually derived? I mean, there's this really extensive history about what BMI actually is and how it was developed. But ultimately, at the end of the day, BMI is a risk score, a risk calculation.
It is.
And all it really, all it actually really kind of means is the higher your score, the greater your chance of having all of these other terrible chronic diseases. So I agree with you in that
so
it is not necessarily always.
it's not always
the best thing to go with. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, I think there will have to be a shift. You know, it's an easy calculation. And so things get latched on because it's easy and it's cheap to do. So there's going to have to eventually be a reevaluation of how this is looked at, you know, maybe looking at terms of percent body fat and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, because I think that could also factor into why the number is high. I'm not saying that I don't think it's a problem. I agree with you. I think the foods that we eat are totally different than what even, you know, I was eating, you know, 30 years ago. So I agree with you. But I also do wonder, like, if we're still going by metrics that are archaic and just don't really match what should be a societal norm today, if that has any kind of factoring into that. So that's good to know.
No, I absolutely agree. 100%. I think it's a very valid point.
Well, Dr. Joe St. Pierre, I loved talking to you this morning. I'd love to have you back on the show again soon. If anybody wants to contact you or your offices, is there a way they could do that?
Yeah, you can just contact for Hartford Healthcare. I have multiple offices within the Fairfield region. I also work with two excellent bariatric surgeons, Dr. Craig Flock and Nick Dugan. I myself am not a surgeon. I'm a medical weight loss doctor. Contact Hartford Healthcare, and if you're interested in coming and seeing us, set up a consult.
All right. Simple enough. And again, thank you so much, Dr. St. Pierre. I really appreciate you coming on this morning, and we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Yeah, that'd be great. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on your show this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Dr. Joe St. Pierre here on WICC, a Hartford Healthcare medical weight loss specialist for the Fairfield region.
She's in our part of Connecticut today. Melissa in the Morning checks in with Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor. How are you today?
Good morning, Melissa. You know, it's Friday the 13th. It's raining, but it's still a good day.
It is. Because you know what? We're up and we've got another day to take on today. So I always think anytime you wake up, that's a good thing. So
absolutely.
Yes. I don't care about the date. I'm just glad that I'm alive another day. So, you know, Lieutenant Governor. Yeah, thank you very much. So, Lieutenant Governor, obviously the big story this week. I'm kind of hailing it probably one of the top stories this year already. I know it's only January in Connecticut, mm-hmm. but it's monumental. We have legalized marijuana basically to its fullest extent at this point because now we are allowing shops to open up and recreational marijuana products are now available to people 21 and older. And of course, this week I was flooded with questions. And I know in speaking to your press team, you know, they said, look, let's dive into it. So I appreciate you coming on and sort of taking our
Absolutely.
Questions on this. Yeah. I think the biggest fear, honestly, that people have is impaired driving. I think that's one of the biggest fears people have. It is here. So there's really no turning back on it. So I didn't know if we had any facts or figures to start off with looking at other states, because Connecticut is not the first. There are other states that have also legalized it.
That's right. There are more than 20 states right now that have recreational marijuana. They've already legalized. And honestly, the biggest impetus for this was the fact that other states had already been out there aggressively marketing, like Massachusetts, like New York City. And until the legislature banned the advertising that you could see as you were driving north or south, you would see Massachusetts aggressively marketing to Connecticut buyers right at the borders. And so we wanted to capture the revenue in taxes, because there's sales tax on marijuana that is going to other states, and also to try to undercut the black market, because now marijuana, or prior to the legal sale of it, marijuana was being sold to people without any kind of health and safety control. So, there was marijuana that was laced with fentanyl, which is deadly. And so we wanted the opportunity to regulate it. And you're right. Yeah. Impairment is an issue, as it is with all substances like alcohol and other drugs. And so we are doing a very comprehensive public service campaign to remind people that, you know, if you're going to use cannabis, use it in your home and don't go anywhere, don't drive, because it's just like alcohol. And combined with alcohol, that causes impairment as well.
So we're talking to the Lieutenant Governor this morning, and if you do have questions in regards to marijuana, we'll have the Lieutenant Governor here until just before 9 o'clock. So feel free to email me directly, or you can call Lieutenant Governor.
I just wanted to say one other thing, Melissa, because, you know, there is a bigger issue around substance abuse that we've seen through the pandemic and throughout the pandemic. And it is and was a very stressful time for people. So we saw an increase in the number of people who were substance abusing. You know, people are drinking more, and also domestic violence doubled during the pandemic. And we know that because domestic violence agencies have told us that. So there's sort of a bigger concern out there that we want people to get treatment if they have an addiction, no matter what it is.
Mm-hmm. So the thing with, you know, pot is I feel like there's no perfect answer. I don't know about you, Lieutenant Governor, and I'm not here to judge. I am not a pot smoker, but I have plenty of people I love very dearly who do smoke pot. And so this was something that to them seemed like a no-brainer. It doesn't personally, as far as me, impact me. Again, the only thing that would impact me is the fact that if I get hit by an impaired driver, then it would impact me. Or if somebody I love, you know, dies from a wrong driver. So I do know that state police are doing what they can to be able to track these drivers, test them on site, and be able to apprehend them. Do you think by legalizing it, we are actually going to decrease the number of impaired drivers? And what I mean by that is because we're now not talking about people crossing state borders to get what they need or to go get high out at bars, or like the fact that we've now made it open, we've made it legal now, it's okay, you're not going to get arrested for it. Do you think we'll actually see a decrease in impaired drivers only from the drugging end of it? Not so much the alcohol. We know the alcohol is still out of control. But from the drugging end, do you think it will get better now that we've legalized it?
It's a little early to say, and I hope you're right. And I do think that there will be a benefit to people who already have. We have 50,000 people that have the medical cards. And with increased production to meet the recreational demand, I think it's going to be cheaper for people who need cannabis for one of the many illnesses and diseases that are already on the list for the medical cards. And a lot of people don't smoke, they consume the edibles. You know, there are gummies, there are brownies and cookies and things that you can eat, which a lot of cancer patients, for example, use. So I think from that perspective, there's a benefit, I hope. And also, we expect that there will be 20,000 new jobs created because of the demand. So there will be growers growing the product in Connecticut. And, you know, there will be all of the related marketing, delivery, and retail positions that will be created as well. So there is an opportunity for job growth. And the other big thing which we haven't mentioned is on January 1st, more than 43,000 cannabis convictions for low-level possession were erased.
Right.
And that's a big deal because the war on drugs really impacted people of color disparately. And so now we have the opportunity to make sure that those old wrongs are redressed, and our Social Equity Council is in the process of getting people in communities of color involved in these new job and business owning and entrepreneurial opportunities, because the legislature was very intentional about making sure that people in communities of color could participate in this new industry.
We are chatting with the Lieutenant Governor this morning. Lieutenant Governor Susan Bicewicz is here, and we did have a couple of emails and questions come through during just that quick break, Lieutenant Governor. This one, kind of going back to what we were just talking about, and I don't know if you have the exact figures on hand with you or if you want to you know, send me to a certain place and I can get them for our listeners. Again, I think going back to alcohol versus marijuana, this was a big question from Bill in Fairfield, but also from many other listeners this week. Do we have any statistics between rates of deaths or major injuries with alcohol versus marijuana impaired drivers?
You know, I really don't know the answer to that. So I will have to make sure we get you those for your listeners.
It might be a state police thing.
Yeah.
I know
we will find out from the state police.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. I know we're going to try to get state police on next week because they've got dozens of troopers who specifically, and they have been, I guess, for over 10 years now, specifically look for drivers who are drugged. So I would imagine I wanted to kind of understand that process and what they're looking for differently than when you're looking for drunk drivers. So maybe they have those stats. But yeah, if you get them first. Totally appreciate you.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Excellent.
Thank
you. We'll do that.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Lieutenant Governor, you were just kind of diving into the convictions and how those have been erased for hundreds of thousands of Connecticut residents. Would you say a majority of them were marijuana convictions? Because I know a lot of people, if they're not reading the news closely, they see, okay, people with criminal backgrounds now are just, you know, have clean slates.
No, it's specifically for possession of small amounts of marijuana without intention to sell. And it was those convictions which disproportionately affected people of color. For instance, the governor and I made our announcement of that in Hartford at a reentry facility, which helps people coming out of the correction system get jobs, get job training, get housing. And we did that in Hartford because 1 in 10 of the convictions overturned were from Hartford residents. And 1 in 10 of the convictions were people of color. 1 in 9 Latino, and 1 in 10 Black. So again, we're trying to redress this disproportionate impact that it's had on communities of color.
Okay. And something else, Lieutenant Governor, I know this was kind of a lottery system of how they decided on who was going to open up a shop. And we know that 7 are currently running. 2 others do have approval. They just haven't opened just yet. Another question, are we going to have another lottery system, or how many shops are we thinking will open even just this year?
It's a little early to know that. Mm-hmm. Right now, the shops that are selling are shops that were dispensaries already for the medical product. So they're called the hybrid facilities. And then there have been over 100 business entities, all of which have social equity partners. So the people of color and entrepreneurs and communities of color, and those business entities have been given licenses, but then there are all kinds of things that they need to do before they get up and running. So right now we're sort of in a runway phase over the next year or two, where we will start to see those businesses get created and open. And I would definitely recommend, Melissa, that you get Paul Robertson in. He's the Deputy Economic Development Commissioner, and he's also the head of the Social Equity Council that is overseeing that process of getting those new businesses up and running. And there'll be opportunities in the future to add more if there looks like there's a demand. It's very early, so we don't know what the demand is out there just yet.
Well, I would love to have Paul Robertson on the show. He's never been on. If you or your team has a contact when we get off the air, would love to get that.
We sure do.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'd love to have him on. I think that'd be really great. And Lieutenant Governor, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I do appreciate you coming on. And I would suspect we're going to have you on very soon again. Always appreciate you stopping by.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And, happy weekend.
Thank you. You as well. Thank you so much. That is the Lieutenant Governor, Susan Bicewicz, here on WICC. Good morning. We are chatting with State Senator Kevin Kelly, who is back here this morning. And good morning to you, Senator Kelly. Glad to have you back. Happy New Year. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. It's good to be back. I'm doing well, and Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Senator Kelly, we have entered a brand new legislative session. First of all, congratulations on being reelected. Have I had you on since you got reelected?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so.
Thank you.
So shame on me. Apologies, but I'm glad to have you back on. Have you taken on any new committees or any new rankings since your last term in office, just to update people?
Yes, this year I'm going to be on higher education and employment advancement for the first time.
Oh, that's exciting.
It is exciting. You know, variety's the spice of life, so we're trying something new, but it's also very important because it's going to deal with our, our higher education college system, both community, regional, and UConn, as well as employment advancement, which is really workforce development. And the whole purpose here is to connect people with opportunity, to expand our kids' skills and improve upon our workforce so that we can create the jobs for, quite frankly, a lot of companies and entities in Connecticut that have them, but we don't have the labor to fill them.
Do you think there's also an issue, though, Senator Kelly, of really retaining? Like, they can attract people to the job, but they really don't do a good enough job of keeping them there.
That's part of it. Also, retaining our talent once it's educated to make sure it stays here in the state of Connecticut. I think that's part of it. So there's a lot of things that go into workforce development. And I mean, there's the ancillary aspects, you know, and these are other things we're working on, like energy and healthcare and housing and making sure that all those are affordable, quite frankly. And you got to keep your eye focused on, you know, what families are experiencing. What does the kitchen table economics look like? And if the kitchen table economics for Connecticut families can be strong and secure, then guess what? People are more likely to stay here, grow here, raise their family here, and work here. If it's not, if it's more likely that if they move somewhere else, they can get that opportunity, they're going to go there. So we've got to do a better job, not just on education and workforce development, but I think it's a more global picture. And it's why, I looked at this. I was like, this is something I haven't done. It's really exciting anytime you're talking about children, students and their future, I mean, and opportunity. It's a fun topic to talk about.
And we're talking to State Senator Kevin Kelly. And Senator Kelly, you're still the minority leader for the Senate, correct?
I am.
Okay. Wanted to make sure I got your title perfectly correct as we go into 2023. Speaking of higher education, I know we have to talk about tax cuts and we've got to talk about energy costs, and we will get to that in 1 second. But I noticed earlier this week, Senator Kelly, that there were a lot of community college students who were up in Hartford really making their voices known because they're nervous that the tuition payments are going to go up because we are seeing that it's happening for our state universities. In fact, I think it was like in the last year it went up 3% for some of our major universities. So what do we do about the tuition costs? And I mean, just how outrageous it is, at least for Connecticut colleges, to afford to go here, especially, when I was growing up, it was attractive to go to a Connecticut college because you could go for a much more affordable rate. And I mean, if you want to go to UConn and you live in Connecticut, it doesn't really seem like it's much of a deal, honestly.
No, UConn is becoming more and more uncompetitive with other state schools. And really, that's a disservice to the kids that grow up here in the state of Connecticut that, you can't go to school and then college at your flagship state university. You're going to have to go to, and you see the signs, you can go to Maine, you can go to other state schools. And we really shouldn't put our students in that position, particularly if we want to reap the benefit of the investment.
Retaining,
that we've
like
made.
You were saying, right,
yeah.
Right.
Now, when you look at something, I was at Southern Connecticut State University yesterday for a New Haven Chamber event, and 85% of graduates from Southern remain in Connecticut.
Oh, that's great. That's a great fact. I didn't know that.
And it's even higher for our community college system. And so we got to look at that, because if the student stays, then not only do we reap the benefit of the investment we made in their education, but we also get a new taxpayer.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's how you grow a tax base. So you got to look at this from a positive perspective, at least from my viewpoint, and community college is even more so. that opportunity. The other part about a community college system is it's unlike the, I'm going to say, the four-year schools where you have dorms, because when you're on campus and you're there, boots on the ground, there are services, and I'm just going to say guardrails, to keep the students on task, on point, moving forward, and making sure that they're getting their FAFSA in, they're getting their tuition paid, they're taking their courses and enrolling at the proper times. Where a commuter school like a community college, those services don't really exist. And we got to do a better job at making sure that support systems are in place, because for the most part, many of the community college student population are first-time students going on to higher education, and they don't have those family support systems that may have done this before them. And so we need to make sure that that's there, as well as that whole affordability issue. Because I'm going to tell you, if you do go into the community college system in Connecticut and you do get an associate's degree, that's 2 years of your four-year degree, and the credits will transfer as long as you go to like another, I'm going to say, state university other than Yale, Trinity, or Wesleyan.
Sure.
They normally accept all the credits. So that's an affordable way to get a four-year degree, very inexpensive, but we've got to keep it that way. And we have, quite frankly, in the current operating budget, we have a surplus in the billions. So this is something that we can afford to do. And quite frankly, as I said before, this is investing in the workforce of Connecticut. This isn't somebody that's going to leave and go somewhere else. The odds are, if you're betting, that person has a greater than 85% chance of staying in Connecticut.
We're chatting this morning with State Senator Kevin Kelly, who is here this morning. And let's talk about some of the big ticket items right now, very early on in the legislative session, up for discussion right now. We actually had the governor on this week, Senator, and he said he agrees to having some tax cuts, especially for the middle class. He said something along the lines of, it obviously it has to be discussed among lawmakers in the legislature, but he would like to see families, I think, making combined under $200,000 to start seeing some tax cuts. And I didn't know what you thought about this. I know this is something the Republican Party has been pushing for, having more tax cuts instead of like holiday breaks. What are your thoughts on what the governor's looking at, and could it be expanded upon?
Well, we see eye to eye with the governor on this initiative. It was actually one that we proposed last spring as part of our budget adjustment. The majority offered $600 million of tax cuts. That's what was adopted. We offered $1.2 billion, twice the amount, that included a cut of 1% in the income tax to households earning less than $200,000, so that we would catch the middle and working class families and give them a break. This would be something permanent, and if you've listened to the governor address the General Assembly on opening day of the session, that's what he was talking about, was cutting the income tax for middle and working class families, something permanent, broad-based, easy to implement. And so we see eye to eye with the governor. We're singing in the same tune. Obviously, the devil will be in the detail, but what we don't want to see are credits or reimbursements where you have to have something to get it. And oftentimes, like we saw with the child credit this past summer, that unless you're applying for it and claiming it, a lot of it goes unused. And that's
or even the hero's pay.
Yes,
I have to say, the hero's pay, they had so many applications, people got denied. I was one of them, actually. I was one of the people who got denied. Yeah.
Renter rebates. There's a whole litany of programs that have been offered but not underutilized. And then what happens is the majority takes that money back and spends it somewhere else. So they almost get a double play on it. They get the benefit of a tax cut, and then they get to spend the money elsewhere.
Mm.
So we want to just impose a cut in the income tax. And another thing that he said that was very important that we see eye to eye on were the caps that resulted from the bipartisan budget when the Senate was tied. and this was in 27 and 18, the Republicans and Democrats shared power in the Senate. And as a result of that, there was a very detailed, well-balanced, bipartisan approach to fiscal stability and responsibility. And it imposed things like a spending cap, bonding cap, volatility cap, a bond lock. And those fiscal guardrails are what has created this statutory maximum in the rainy day fund. It has required the state to pay down billions in debt and has afforded the taxpayers, I'm going to say, an income tax or tax breaks. And that's because just in what's gone on in the past couple of years, we now have $440 million extra dollars in the budget from savings on debt service. So the governor and the Republicans see eye to eye that these need to be extended as they are. They're working. You know, it ain't broke. Don't fix it. And it's something that has put Connecticut on better fiscal footing, and it's serving the people. Now, there's people in the legislature that would like to start to, you know, do revision here or there. But I think if you open up the door, who knows where it goes, and it might not work because what is there was a negotiated by both parties, a detail-oriented and a well-balanced approach to our fiscal management, and it's serving Connecticut very well. The taxpayers are getting a benefit on this, and both of us see that this needs to continue.
I think that's really encouraging in itself. In a world that's so divided right now, here in Connecticut, you've got a Democratic governor who's seeing eye to eye with the Republican Party. Like, I think that's really refreshing as well. On top of everything you just said, Senator, I think that's really refreshing to hear.
Well, you know, we always believe when we proposed these last year, and I know you've heard me say this when we talk about insurance and health care, that good ideas find friends. And I think giving the middle and working class a break on income tax, I think keeping fiscal guardrails in place that are paying down our debt, keep making sure we have a rainy day fund that's at its maximum, and contributing more money to the general fund so that not only can we provide more tax service, but also maintain the services that we have. This is, you know, it's working. And so I think, and I'm hopeful, we find more friends to rally around these issues.
Senator Kelly, unfortunately, we have run out of time. I know I want to talk about other big things like energy costs, but luckily you're going to be coming on throughout the session, and I'm very excited to have you back on the show, and I thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, and stay tuned. You'll see an energy policy coming out early next week that I think is going to be very exciting.
Okay, perfect. Well, maybe you want to come back on the show so we could talk a little bit more about that. That would be great.
Definitely.
Okay, fantastic. Senator Kevin Kelly, always appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being here. All right, we're going to talk more to Senator Kelly probably next week. He said, stay tuned. There's some kind of energy bill coming our way, and he seemed happy about it. So that would mean the Republican Party has some support behind it. So we'll talk about that coming up next week.